This is Bronwyn Schwagert, licensed therapist and author at the Angry at the Right Things podcast. Instead of controlling our anger, we'll be looking at what causes it in the first place so we can rectify what's dysfunctional in our lives and in the world. Here we go. Hi, and welcome to Angry at the Right Things. This is Bronwyn, and I have Katie here with me.
Hello, everybody.
It is Cinco de Mayo. Happy Cinco de Mayo. Yeah. We obviously haven't had our margaritas yet, have we?
Nope.
No. Not yet. After the podcast, after we record. So I just want to encourage everyone, if you like what you hear today, please subscribe. Please leave me a 5-star review. And please share with a friend who you think could use what has helped you today. But let's go ahead and start with today, one of many topics that we're going to cover today, and they all blend together. And that is what I am calling the life-saving power of belief. Yeah, that's just my title.
All right.
Okay. Did it reel you in?
It did.
It did. Yeah. Okay. So it worked on Katie. So I want to talk about suicide prevention, and I want to really change the way we look at suicide prevention, because when I was in grad school, so I was about to graduate from my program, I was starting out as a trainee. I did a suicide prevention training, and you know, it's crazy. I told you this the other day, Katie, that looking back now on what I learned back then, I'm like, that was the worst suicide training, prevention training ever. I can't even believe that I thought it would help someone.
Really?
Yeah. So I want to talk about what actually can prevent suicide and really the framework for this, so we can all feel empowered to be in the know, because you know, that is a scary thing to think about, you know, someone who might attempt suicide. And I think we all need to be empowered. I don't think we should have to pay, like I did, to go to a weekend training and then be, you know, taught really unhelpful material that actually just makes you feel like, you know, for me, it made me feel more like I don't know what I'm doing, actually. And it didn't really empower us or equip us to help anyone in the first place. So I want to really kind of do justice to this.
All right. I can't wait to hear what you have to say.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good. Me neither. So when I was trained, what they kind of led us to believe was that we're going to somehow encounter someone who's about to end their life. And we're going to like see them on a bridge and they're about to like throw themselves over, or they've got the gun in their hand and they're about to use it. And they trained us in like this formulaic thing where we're supposed to go up to them and say, "Hey, what are your reasons for dying?" And then they tell us, and then we say, "Well, what are your reasons for living?" And then they're kind of going to go, "Oh, wow. Good question, stranger. You know, now that I'm thinking about it, I do have some reasons for living. Thank you for helping me think that through." I mean, sorry. First of all, what is the likelihood that any of us are going to encounter someone who's a stranger who is about to commit suicide?
Right. Like that only happens on TV.
That's like a movie kind of thing. Exactly. Yeah. The truth is, people in our lives, our coworkers, our family members, our friends, our acquaintances, our neighbors go in and out of depressive episodes, and we are likely never going to know if they are even contemplating suicide. But the truth is that, you know, they've done studies that almost everyone has suicidal ideation at least once in their life. And so it's going to happen, but we're not going to be aware of it. They're not going to say, Hey, Katie, I think I might kill myself. Do you want to talk me out of it? You know, right. We're just not going to have that opportunity. But we will be around people who are contemplating suicide and we won't know it. Mm-hmm. And so I want to talk about that because the chance of them telling us is so minimal, but the chance of us encountering people who really are contemplating it or having some type of suicidal ideation are extremely high. Mm-hmm. So let's just look at this from a different framework. So what I think is most important and the reason why I call this the life-saving power of belief is we need to believe people, not necessarily when they're telling us they're going to end their lives. I think most of us would believe them then, but we just need to be people who believe what the people around us are saying and take it seriously. And you know, I have attempted suicide myself. All of the therapists, the licensed therapists I have gone to throughout my life, very few of them, I felt like they really believed what I was saying. And I'm not referring to suicide here. I'm talking about, you know, if I said, you know, I was just a complete shithead to my daughter today. And it really breaks my heart because she's only 11. And I really regret what I said. And a lot of them would just not take it that seriously.
Like dismiss you.
Dismiss it and be like, oh yeah, we all do that. Or she'll forgive you. And it's like, can you just really believe what I'm telling you right now? Can you really take this seriously? Because it needs to be taken seriously. And I don't want to have to repeat myself. Can you just really believe me right now?
Right.
And honest to God, the one time I went to a non-licensed counselor, she was a religious counselor, and I don't share a lot of things. I don't believe in, you know, really what she had to offer in many ways. I don't agree with her on many things, but her name was Natalie. She's an older woman. The one thing she did right, which is so ironic because all these licensed therapists didn't do this, is she believed me. She really believed
me. How did she show you that she believed you?
Okay, I'm going to share something. I'm going to divulge something that's very hard to recant. This was one of the lowest periods of my life. This is around the time I attempted suicide. And I was so depressed. And Edie, this is when she was acting like I was her enemy all the time, and I was really struggling. And we went to visit a mutual friend once at a hospital who had just had a surgery. And Edie, I felt so rejected by her because as Steve and Edie and I were walking through the hospital, Edie wasn't even walking with us. She was like pretending like she didn't know us, which I know is normal sometimes, but she was so pronounced in how she did it. And it was like, I felt so rejected by her. I felt so humiliated. I was already so depressed. And I'm not condoning what I did, but I was in such a desperate place. I got so angry with her because she refused to walk with us when I tried to get her to. I grabbed her by the throat.
Oh, right.
And I accidentally, my fingernail went into her throat and it caused her neck to bleed. Mm-hmm. And that just, it just made me feel like absolute shit. I could see her neck bleeding. Mm-hmm. She's crying. And now she's angrier at me than before. And I just felt like I wanted the hospital floor. I wanted a big hole to open up and I wanted to be swallowed into the hole. It was like, I just went from bad to worse because mm-hmm. now I feel like an absolute monster. And she tells our mutual friend what happens when we go see her in her hospital room.
Oh.
And I'm like, okay, just kill me now. It was one of the worst all-time lows of my life. And when I went to see Natalie, the counselor, she listened to me. And she looks at me and she goes, well, Edie must have really hurt you. Mm-hmm. She must have really been a monster too. And, you know, that was exactly what I needed to hear. Mm-hmm. I needed her to believe me. I needed her to be on my side. She wasn't condoning what I did.
Right.
But I felt, I felt very, like, I felt heard and it was therapeutic.
Understood.
I felt, like, understood. Mm-hmm. And I felt like less of a monster.
Like you reacted in a human way, even though it
was. Yeah. Yes. Great. It was like she humanized me. We always hear people say, you're dehumanizing. It was like she was humanizing me by believing me, believing that I was in that much pain to do that.
Yeah.
And not monstering me, not dehumanizing me more. I was doing that to myself already. Mm-hmm. And so I just wanted to talk about this because, you know, so many licensed therapists don't believe their clients and they dismiss it, or they just kind of will keep talking and kind of like talk about something else and change the subject. And guys, if we have people in our lives and we don't know where they're at mentally, we don't know how much they're struggling with suicidal ideation, let's start with believing them. Let's start with like really believing whatever they're telling us. And here's the thing I have found as a therapist. Because a lot of therapists, if you come to them and you say something, they will play devil's advocate.
Right.
And there is a time and a place for that. But it's not when that person is first sharing with you. First, we lead with belief. Mm-hmm. We lead with giving them the benefit of the doubt, attuning to them, listening, asking good questions, and validating.
Right.
And what I've also found is that over time, when people feel believed, when they feel validated, when they feel that trust in you, they themselves will later say, well, you know, I think I really am more to blame than I've divulged so far. And then you're like, oh, tell me about that. And they will start owning their contribution on their own. We don't need to do that.
Okay.
Now, not everyone's going to do that. Mm-hmm. And some of those people over time, as they trust us and we have that rapport with them, but we lead with belief, we can challenge it. But that is a timing thing. That is not how we lead.
Right. They have to feel trust.
Absolutely. They have to feel trusted.
They're not going to be rejected for sharing how they really feel.
They're not going to be challenged right away. Mm-hmm. They're not going to be rejected. They're not going to be shamed. They're not going to be judged, because we all know most of us are really adept at doing that to ourselves.
Yeah.
So we need to be either the therapist or the friend or the coworker or the family member or the neighbor who believes. Mm-hmm. And I think that is how we fight suicidal ideation, is we just be that safe person in people's lives who believe them.
I like that. It's very simple but powerful.
I think so.
Yeah.
And we don't say it enough. So yeah, so some of the things we can look for if we are thinking about suicide, though, is we can know if we see signs of depression. So that is, you know, depression means that person doesn't have a lot of affect. Hmm. So their voice, their tone of voice might just be flat. Their face might be flat. The look in their eyes might be flat. Or they talk about feeling hopeless or worthless. Those are commonalities. They might say that they're depressed, but they might not. But they also might show symptoms like withdrawal. They're withdrawing from people, isolating. And then there's this word that we therapists use called anhedonia.
Hmm.
Have you heard of that?
I've heard it, but I don't know what it means.
So it's just a word for lack of joy. So an, it means without, and then like hedonism, anhedonia.
Oh, so like when they list the description of depression symptoms and they say loss of enjoyment in activities you used to.
Yes,
like,
right? That is anhedonia. Okay. So you could be going to Disneyland, but you're not enjoying Disneyland.
Yeah.
So those things that should be making you happy are no longer. And you can see that if you know people, you can kind of see that in their affect, in their expression or lack thereof. So how do we prevent suicide? We don't go looking for it. We just become that good person in people's lives who show, like, we show that we care, mm-hmm. and we believe and we listen and we ask good questions and we just get to know the people in our lives. And that's all we need to do. And we might be saving a lot of, not a lot, but we might be saving like several people's lives and never be aware of it, just because we're that one person that they can talk to and open up to that does care.
Right.
And that does believe them. And that's what my suicide prevention training would really be about. Mm-hmm. Is just give a shit. So let's talk about attunement and how empathy builds a bridge.
Okay.
So a couple weeks ago, Steve and I went to Yosemite together for a few days, as you know, Katie, and he shared with me how hard it is for him to empathize with me and others when he doesn't feel the same feelings himself.
Okay.
So in other words, if I'm angry at something, but he's not angry at something, he's like, I can't attune to you. Mm-hmm. I can't empathize because I don't feel that anger myself. That's actually not empathy. That's just resonating with the other person at the same vibrational frequency, basically, but it's not empathy, mm-hmm. what he's referring to. And so I found myself kind of explaining what empathy is to him. And I wanted to share this with our listeners today as well, because I see empathy as a bridge that we build between ourselves and another person, and it has to engage our imagination.
Hmm.
So we don't have to feel the same feelings that person is at all, but we do that through engaging our imagination. So when someone else is telling us about how angry they were at, you know, the driver or whatever, you know, in front of them, we just imagine it was happening to us.
Right.
And then we just really allow ourselves to feel that feeling. And then we're empathizing.
Hmm.
It doesn't come without engaging our imagination.
That makes sense. It's kind of like the old-fashioned thing of walking a mile in somebody's shoes.
Exactly.
Right?
Like it is.
You really do have to use your brain. It's not just going to like magically happen. You have to.
Yeah. It's work, and it is enlisting our imagination. And mm-hmm. so we have to think of that. We're not going to naturally share the same feelings someone else is sharing, especially if we haven't gone through the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't have to. And that gives us freedom too, because empathy gives us freedom. Like, I'm just listening to you. And as I'm listening, I'm thinking, oh, that would be humiliating.
Mm-hmm.
Or that would feel blindsiding to have someone just say that out of the blue. And you're just thinking, like, what are they feeling? I can imagine it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just want to encourage everyone out there that requires deep listening, and it requires listening with the goal of understanding. And getting back to all these bad therapists, and there are many, unfortunately, a lot of therapists even, and I think most of the general public, doesn't listen with the goal to understand.
Right. I think I know what you're saying.
Well, mm-hmm. tell me what you're thinking, because I just saw your face kind of.
Like listening, sort of like, what is it I'm thinking of? Sort of. It's like pretending to care, kind of like, you know, like not pretending, that's not really fair, but not, you know, listening, but not really taking it in and thinking about it.
Not with
any depth, you know?
Yeah. So kind of just light listening.
Yeah. Like what's the phrase I'm thinking of? just kind of going through the motions.
Yeah.
Sort of. Yeah.
So there's going through the motions listening. I think a lot of people, including therapists, unfortunately, listen with the goal of responding, like thinking, what am I going to say back? And I think a lot of therapists, honestly, feel really nervous about how they're going to respond, mm-hmm. as I think the rest of, you know, the population does too. What if we just gave up on even thinking about how we're going to respond? What if we just make our number one objective to listen in order to understand, and we just allow whatever happens after that to just happen naturally? Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
Because even if I don't respond, if I have a client who's telling me something and I'm looking at them on the screen, they can see my face, and I'm just, my face looks like it, my face and the look on my face is therapeutic, because they're looking at me and they can tell I am being very affected by what they're saying. I care. They can see like my brows are furrowed, like kind of like a, wait, what? Mm-hmm. You know, like a shock look or a look of concern. So even if I don't say anything, just the look on my face tells them that they are being like heard and understood.
And the nonverbal cues can be validating. Right?
Absolutely. So I just want everyone to take off the pressure. Let's just listen with the goal of understanding, knowing that just the look on your face, just your nodding, your eye contact, that's enough. It really is. Because you're deep listening. And then you can ask like some good questions. Like, here's some, you know, guys, these are freebies. Here's some really good questions to ask. Tell me more. Help me understand. How did you feel when he said that?
Yeah, those are good.
Those are open-ended questions. Just ask those. Or you can kind of paraphrase. So, Katie, are you saying that? Mm-hmm. And then I'm kind of summarizing. You can do that. That makes someone feel very heard. And then they can clarify. No, Bronwyn, I'm actually saying this. Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Can you see this? Like, the whole goal is just to understand.
Right.
That is the first priority. And that is enough. Mm-hmm. That is enough. And then if you want to add to that, you can just name the feeling. So you must have felt blindsided when he said that in front of everyone.
Right.
And then that person might say, you know, I didn't feel blindsided, but I did feel like disturbed. And you're like, oh, you felt disturbed. I can see why you felt disturbed.
Right.
So can you see how what I'm doing, I'm just slowing it down. I'm slowing it down. I'm helping them process. Right. I'm helping their body process what really happened. And as they're talking, as they're sharing, a lot of people go, you know, now that I'm actually talking about it, I'm realizing that I actually had the red flag and I didn't see it. And so we're creating an environment for the person to come to all these epiphanies, all these revelations on their own, to make these associations, these connections on their own. And we're giving them that environment to do so just by talking and feeling heard and feeling understood. And they're starting to understand themselves. Mm-hmm. And that is powerful.
That makes sense.
And again, a lot of therapists don't even do this. So again, if we're talking about helping prevent suicide, again, like, we need to be these people. We need to really learn how to listen, because it's not common sense, and or it's uncommon sense, I guess, you know?
Yeah.
So deep listening, there is a term in physics called sympathetic resonance. And we might have learned this like back in high school when we learned about tuning forks.
Oh, okay.
So this is so interesting. So when an object vibrates at the same frequency as another, okay, so energy is stored inside of objects, and when one object vibrates at the same frequency as another, the energy stored in the first object is now released.
Mm.
And that is called sympathetic resonance.
Okay.
And so tuning forks are an example of that. And I believe that this happens in humans, that our feelings are the energy stored inside our body
mm-hmm.
that need to be released. And we can only do that when another human engages their imagination, deep listening, and empathizes with us. And I believe that empathy is the listening is the sympathetic resonance it is the frequency that allows sympathetic resonance to take place. And so that energy is now being released out of my body because what's shareable is bearable. And so now I feel better because I'm not storing anger
right
in my body anymore.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, tuning forks, we say tuning. Attunement.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about attunement. That's what attunement is.
Right. Right.
You have a big smile on your face.
No,
you
I
like
just
that?
Like, I like your thought process there.
Yeah, I believe it's true.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I think you're exactly right.
So let's talk about timing, because we did talk about that a little bit already, that we lead by believing people. It's important to build people's trust, and timing is important. I want to talk more about timing. So a lot of my clients, when they come to therapy, they have learned to dissociate from their feelings throughout their lifetime, especially anger, because that's the scary one.
Yeah.
Because as very young children, they implicitly learned that if they show anger, they will be abandoned by their primary caregiver, which is usually mom. And they will be abandoned in like silent treatment or being ignored, you know, or some kind of thing like that. And that feels like absolute abandonment to a little child. And so they have learned to dissociate from their anger and, you know, it gets them through. But when they come to me and they're in their 20s or 30s or 40s or 50s, my job is to say, you know what? You have disassociated from your anger your whole life. And now is the time to start connecting to it again,
mm-hmm.
or maybe for the first time, really,
yeah.
since you were two. And it's hard because that's scary for a lot of my clients. Like that is terrifying actually for them.
Definitely.
And so I want to say is there is a time and a season for all things.
Mm-hmm.
And it is when we have a decent therapist or a decent friend, or are in a good place in our life, it's time for us to reconnect. It's time. It's such a time as this, right? It's a Chronos time.
Mm-hmm.
And when we can finally feel our feelings, it's uncomfortable and it's messy, but it is like a rebirth. Which, by the way, birth is a messy process, but it's a beautiful process and it's a necessary process if you want to have a child. So it's an awakening where we become more fully alive and more fully human. And it's not easy, but it is good. And continuing in our avoidance of feeling our anger and connecting to our anger is not as much like staying asleep as much as it is like remaining dead.
Yeah.
Because I have talked to enough people who will tell me when I finally connected to my anger, Bronwyn, it was like coming alive for the first time. It really is. And again, we're not talking about becoming a raging, angry person. We're right, talking about just right. connecting to our anger internally and then channeling that anger into boundaries and assertiveness and accountability.
Right.
Right? So it is time, and there is a time for this. And I just wanted to read one, a really famous passage of the book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 3, that a lot of people know, and it talks about timing because I feel like this is really apropos. It says, there is a time for everything and a season for every activity under the heavens, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to uproot, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to tear down and a time to build, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to scatter stones and a time to gather them, a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to search and a time to give up, a time to keep and a time to throw away, a time to tear and a time to mend, a time to be silent and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace.
Mm. Yeah.
So
good stuff.
I want to encourage people. There is a time for this, and I hope everyone can make that a priority.
Good advice.
Okay. Let's talk about differentiation versus enmeshment.
Mm.
Because if you are not fully differentiated from your parents, you are enmeshed still.
Mm.
And it can be sneaky. And the reason I wanted to bring this up is because, again, when Steve and I were in Yosemite the other week, we were hiking and we were talking about my relationship with my dad. And he goes, yeah, you weren't really enmeshed with your dad, were you? And I was like, wait, yeah, I actually really was. And he goes, no, you weren't. Like, you didn't visit him that much or talk to him that much on the phone. And I started thinking, yeah, I didn't look enmeshed mm-hmm. from like those common metrics, but I was. And so enmeshment can be sneaky. It's not always obvious.
Mm.
So really wanted to talk about that. So let's talk about differentiation. Differentiation is something that cells do.
Mm.
Cells, in order to be born fully, a cell has to differentiate from its parent cell.
Okay.
When cells divide, right?
Right, right.
And when cells don't fully differentiate from the parent cell,
mm-hmm.
when they don't become their own, they don't distinguish themselves by becoming their own cell with their own cellular membrane that is 100% theirs, boundary,
mm-hmm.
then that cell never has their function. They're never able to function according to their DNA blueprint.
Mm.
And those cells are also the most likely cells to become cancer cells.
Interesting.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
So I feel like that is a very good metaphor for people who have never differentiated, because people who have never differentiated from their parents often never fulfill their specific function or role that their blueprint, internal blueprint, has designed them for.
Hmm.
So I'll give you an example. People who are not differentiated oftentimes do for a living what their parents always wanted them to do.
Okay.
So I'm going to give you an example. And it makes me sad. Because when I don't go to doctors very often, but I swear most of the time I have gone to doctors,
mm-hmm.
I think to myself, this poor guy, he's just doing this because this is what his mommy wanted him to do, because he obviously hates what he's doing and he obviously mm-hmm. hates people and he just seems really miserable.
Right.
And guys, it is true. There are a lot of doctors who are just doing this to make their parents happy.
Mm-hmm.
And they are not differentiated. And it makes me sad because they kick their own ass
mm-hmm.
to go through years and years and years of school to be miserable.
Yeah, that is sad.
And that's just one example.
Mm-hmm.
But people who are not differentiated are not fulfilling their own DNA blueprint. They are not functioning according to the role that I believe they have been designed to fulfill.
Mm.
And so I want to just kind of pose this question. What if each one of us has a unique blueprint inside us that longs to be realized? What if some people are designed to be musicians and other people are to be accountants and others to be professors and some to be visionaries? And what if we severed the emotional umbilical cord to our parents and moved toward fulfilling our true calling in life and became completely differentiated?
Hmm.
What if we gave ourselves the approval we have been longing for from our parents and allowed ourselves to disappoint the hell out of everyone else?
Hmm. Yeah.
Wouldn't that be amazing?
Wouldn't it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We are not fully differentiated until there is removal of all enmeshment. And again, enmeshment can be sneaky. And my relationship with my dad, again, it was very sneaky. One of the things that I realized kept me enmeshed to him was this false hope that I had of him. I really believed that deep down under the gruff and sometimes cruel exterior, that there was a soft marshmallowy center of empathy.
Mm-hmm.
And that kept me believing that someday I'm going to see that side of him, that he'll empathize with me, he'll care.
Right.
And it wasn't until I started to realize that the reason I have believed that for so long is because he shows his own vulnerability in attempts to engage my empathy. Mm. So his eyes will tear up at times as he talks about things that are hard for him. But I had to realize, oh yeah, he wants my empathy, but he has never been empathic to me.
No. Yeah.
Never.
Yeah.
And once I could see that, I realized, oh, that's a lie that I'm hanging on to.
Mm-hmm.
That he has this soft, cushiony center of empathy. That's a lie. And see, lies entangle.
Yeah.
And those tangles are how we get enmeshed.
Right.
Right? Because I think of enmeshed, the word enmeshment, it's like two cords that are knotted together, and those knots are those tangles, and those tangles are created by lies that we believe about that person. And once we unravel those knots, because we see this is actually not true, this is false, this is a false hope, that's when we break free.
Right. Yeah.
Are you relating to that?
Yeah. Yeah.
How so?
Just I'm empathizing with you.
Okay. You're not.
I'm not for me personally at the moment, but just thinking about your, you and your dad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah. So what I want to say is that if we unravel and become, differentiated from our parents, and we have our own boundaries and our separation, we can choose to have a relationship with them if they, you know, meet our demands, which are basically to be a safe person. We can choose that later. But if we do enter into a relationship with them later, we enter that relationship as an adult, as a whole person.
Yeah.
And so we can engage with them in a very different way than entering that relationship as a child who still needs their approval or their recognition, right?
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It does.
And so this is really imperative for any relationship, such as marriage, because if we are still undifferentiated from our parents, we enter into a relationship like marriage or a romantic relationship, It's like we are a half looking for someone to make us whole. And that's not going to be the basis of a good marriage.
No.
Or a good commitment. When we're differentiated, we're whole. And now we're looking for an equal, a companion.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing more. And those are so a marriage, a union of two wholes coming together, that is beautiful.
Right.
But we don't want to enter a marriage or a long-term commitment as two halves.
No.
Right?
Like the two broken pieces don't make a
whole. That's right.
Don't make a whole.
Because now we're going to have an enmeshed relationship with our spouse or with our partner.
Right.
Right. Another way I was enmeshed with my father is, and I think a lot of listeners are going to relate to this, is I learned how good it felt to attune to him. Because remember, we all need to feel important to our parents. We all need to feel seen. And even if we're the ones that are supposed to be attuned to by the parent and not vice versa, if we don't feel seen and attuned to by the parent, we will attune to them in order to feel seen and important to them. And so that's what we do. And so I remember my first taste of feeling seen by my father was actually in grad school.
Okay.
And I just want to share about that a little bit, reflect on that. So I was in my mid-20s and I was newly married, and Steve and I were living in Boston, and I was, you know, I'm from California, and I'm going to an Ivy League level school of graduate school. My dad is a university professor, and it's kind of a big deal. And when he comes to visit, you know, visit us in Boston, you would think that as a professor, he would ask me, you know, Bronwyn, tell me how your school experience is going. Like, what are you learning? What passions are being evoked for you? Tell me, how is it affecting you? How is it like changing the way you see the world and what you want to do when you graduate? No, he didn't ask any of those questions. I don't think he asked a single question.
Wow.
About my graduate school experience. What did he do? He wanted us to show him around Boston and play tour guide. And we did. And that is the first time I remember feeling seen and feeling important to my dad, because Boston's a beautiful city. Now, my dad, he taught in the Department of Architectural Engineering as a professor. So we're walking around and there's this, you know, beautiful architecture of the Back Bay and, you know, the buildings in Boston. And I felt really seen and really powerful and really important that time, because I saw how I could make my dad's face light up, showing him around Boston. And that was the imprint on me, that imprinted young Bronwyn's brain to go, oh, you can feel seen by dad by showing him around. And so every place we lived after that, I would always take him and we'd walk around parts of the neighborhood or parts of the city. And I would always do that. And, you know, I felt really good for maybe like 8 hours.
Right.
And sometimes his face never lit up. And that I felt really bad. I felt really disappointed. But that is how young Bronwyn, her brain was imprinted to feel seen by dad, is showing him around, showing him the architecture of the homes and the buildings wherever we lived. And so we all do that in some way. And I became addicted to that feeling. And when we would talk on the phone, I would actually plan my conversation ahead of time, thinking of topics, brainstorming about what he would be interested in talking about, because I want to make sure, you know, these are topics my dad is interested in. So I was totally just attuning to him all the time.
Right.
And, you know, when he visited us in Sacramento, you know, he's really into wine. He's a super big wine aficionado. So I plan to take him to a beautiful winery. And I saw his face light up and he was so happy and I felt great for 8 hours. And it's like, it becomes this addiction. And yet when my mom was dying and I was attuning to him, giving him all that empathy and concern, that's when I realized, oh, he has no empathy or concern for me.
Right.
Because my mom's dying, not just his wife.
Yeah.
My mom.
Yeah.
And he showed zero concern for me. So that's when that knot became unraveled.
Right.
When I realized, oh, it's all about him. It's a one-way attunement thing. And then when I got angry. And so when we get angry, when those lies are exposed, we become free.
Yeah. That's powerful stuff.
It's powerful stuff. So what I want to say is we can also be enmeshed with a parent who is dead.
Mm.
Yeah.
Really?
Oh, yeah. And this is when we still hold on to the implicit beliefs that they taught us. So, for example, even though my whole life, I really never trusted my mom, I never respected her, I still unconsciously picked up some of her false beliefs, and she had a lot of false beliefs. So, for example, she modeled for me throughout my life that cleaning the house and cooking is exhausting. It's just exhausting. that's how she used to say it.
Yeah.
That was the word she always used. And it was just so taxing and laborious and drudgery. Is that the mm-hmm. right word? And it took me a long time to unlearn this for myself. Because implicit beliefs are dangerous because we don't know they're there. They're unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
So it took me until the last, you know, honestly, the last few years for me to wake up and realize I actually love cleaning my house and I love cooking and I love grocery shopping and I love planning my recipes and I love even like gardening.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not exhausting. It's the opposite. It, to me, it is life-giving. It's nurturing. And it took me a long time to unlearn those beliefs. And I was still enmeshed with her because I still ascribed to these lies.
Mm. Yeah. That's so interesting.
And another lie, honestly, probably the worst that I learned from her both implicitly and explicitly was to never trust anyone.
Oh.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Well, if we have a strong borderline personality disorder parent,
mm-hmm.
they don't trust people.
That's true.
And they might explicitly communicate that, but they will definitely show it implicitly by never trusting anyone and always like making comments about the person after they leave. And and so when you see a parent do that over and over, it models for you. You don't trust people and you don't trust the parent because you see how they're so nice to the person's face. And the minute the door is closed, they're talking shit about them. And so you don't trust your own parent.
Mm-hmm.
And when you don't trust your own parent, that is a template for you not to trust anyone. So a lot of this is unconscious.
Mm.
And so, guys, if you have a borderline personality disorder parent, you probably have a very hard time trusting people. And this is a foundational borderline belief. Distrust everyone.
Mm.
But I do want to say it is not 100% bad. So I want to just share a little story. Katie, I've never shared this with you. So Steve, my husband, is a complete pleaser. He's codependent. Mm-hmm. And I come on from the borderline spectrum. And I remember a conversation when we first got to know each other. He had me over to his house for dinner. And I remember I said something about how I didn't like people initially. and they had to win my like.
Ah.
And he said to me back, isn't it just easier to like everybody?
Oh, wow. Wow. How like emblematic of your different, you know.
Right.
Personality.
That's exactly
types.
Emblematic. So wow. A codependent, that's an exact codependent thing to say. Like, I just like everyone. I just give everyone the benefit of the doubt. It's just so easy to like everyone.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. Just assume people are being honest and that people are good. And mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
That is a dangerous assumption as well. Mm-hmm. And so I have really come to see now that we need to find this healthy middle between the borderlines who don't trust anyone and the codependents on the other side who trust everyone and they trust too much. And we need to have the savvy and the shrewdness to be in the middle and to have a healthy skepticism with everyone, but also be open to trusting people. Because a borderline is never truly open to trusting people.
Right.
But a codependent never has that healthy skepticism. Mm-hmm. And we need to have both.
Balance.
Yes.
Yeah.
And we need to be able to move up and down the trust pendulum as we get to know people.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
So this is like a moving target.
So we know where to put our boundaries, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So I want to talk a little bit about OCD and what I have come to believe it really is all about.
Mm.
So there are therapists who specialize in helping people with OCD. However, I'm just going to go on the record saying all they do is manage symptoms of a very deep rooted, well, of a rooted problem. And all people who go to OCD, you know, specialty kind of therapy are getting is symptom management.
Right.
And it's really sad.
Hmm. Is that like CBT type stuff?
Yeah, there's special kind of therapy for people with OCD, like exposure therapy, working up to that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is very kind of, here we do this and then we work up to this and then we, you know, and guys, all you're doing is managing symptoms and those people's symptoms will change if you're not dealing with the root. And so I want to talk about what I believe is the root of people with the people with OCD. So OCD stands for obsessive compulsive disorder. And obsessive compulsive disorder is composed of obsessive thoughts and compulsive behaviors. It can take a lot of forms, but if you look at the different forms, the common forms of real OCD, you're going to see the common thread is a fear of hurting someone.
Mm-hmm.
It really is the common thread.
Yeah.
And the reason people with OCD are afraid to hurt someone, what I'm learning as a therapist is because that person has disassociated from her feelings of rage or hatred, usually at a parent, because it's scary to think about hating your parent and you feel bad and you feel guilty. And so when you disassociate from those feelings, they take on a life of their own. And that's what I really believe OCD is for most people. So let me give you an example. So a very classic example of OCD is when someone has like this obsessive fear that they're going to hit someone when they're driving. Mm. So those are the obsessive thoughts. The compulsive behavior there is they stop to check if they ran someone over.
Mm.
And that is like a classic OCD. Okay. Example.
I didn't know that.
You've never heard of that? Mm-mm. Oh, yeah. It's classic. So if you can look at it from my vantage point now, I see it as the root here is that they feel hatred towards their mother. And if you have a severe borderline parent, of course you hate your mother. Of course you kind of have a passive death wish towards that parent because life would be easier without them. And you're dissociating from that because it feels like that makes you evil to feel those things or have those wishes. Mm-hmm. And so it shows up in your driving where you're like now afraid to kill someone and afraid that you have killed someone. And so you're stopping the car to make sure. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So I absolutely believe this because I see it with so many of my clients. And what, because those feelings feel dangerous. Mm-hmm. Rage and hatred and like wishing the parent were dead, it feels dangerous and we dissociate from it. And so again, it shows up, those dangers show up in the OCD itself. So in order to stop dissociating from our feelings of hate and rage, we need to understand those feelings are not a reflection of us. They're a reflection of them. In other words, if I feel hatred at my mother and I kind of passively wish she'd just no longer be here, that's not a reflection of me. That's a reflection of her.
Okay.
So there's no guilt from me feeling that.
So it's a reflection of her
being a monster?
How that parent has treated you.
Yeah.
How they've interacted with
if
you.
She's a monster, it's my feelings of hatred towards her are a reflection of her being a monster.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
They're not a reflection of me being the monster. Because as a human, when someone behaves in a way that is objectively evil, we're going to naturally feel hatred. Like that's a natural human response. It's involuntary. We're going to just feel hatred. And that's not a bad feeling to have when someone is evil. It's actually a really good feeling because our feelings give us vital information. They say, stay away from this person. They are objectively evil or behaving in ways that are evil. Mm-hmm. But as a child, you can't have that big fat boundary with your parent. And so you just feel hatred all the time. But then you start thinking, I'm the one who's evil, instead of seeing those feelings as a reflection of their evil.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that's the resolution, is we start seeing, oh, I kind of wish my mom were dead because she's evil. And my life actually would be much more peaceful without her. And those feelings don't make me evil because I'm not going to act on them. I'm actually not planning to kill her anytime soon or ever. Mm-hmm. But they're just there because my life needs to be without her. And those feelings are there to give me information to inform me that my life really needs to be without her. So I need to have a big boundary, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And then the OCD is a thing no more. It's a thing of the past.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. So no judgment for those feelings of hatred, of wishing your parent were dead, because they're involuntary. And again, they're there to inform us and give us wisdom in how we should act, such as no longer engaging with this person. So I've mentioned this in a previous episode, but there was that memoir by Jeanette McCurdy.
Right.
Do you remember the title?
Yes.
It's called I'm Glad My Mom Died. That is the title of her book.
Yeah.
And she was the child actress.
Yeah.
And it does sound harsh. And when you talk about the title of her book, you're like, man, that's harsh. But then when you read her book, you just go, oh, this is not a spiteful thing. This is just the natural conclusion that anyone would objectively draw when you read about this mother. Like in order for Jeanette to live, her mom either needs to be dead or not in her life.
Right.
So if we have an evil parent who engages in an evil way with us, even if they act nicely to everyone else, but if they are evil in how they engage with us, we're going to feel hatred. We're going to feel like we wish they were dead. Mm-hmm. That's just a normal human response. Okay, so a lot of people feel very guilty for feeling hatred toward a parent because in our culture, we hear things like, that's your mother. You can't hate your mother. You can't cut yourself off from your mother. You've got to love your mother.
Right.
And what I want to say is when people say these things to you, I want to tell you that the person who's telling that to you is likely in denial of their own hatred at their own mother. I'm not kidding.
No, I believe you. Yeah. I believe it. Yeah.
Because they're being, what you're saying is too evocative.
That's such an uncomfortable thought to them.
It's right? evocative.
Yeah.
And yeah. if it's not evocative, they're not going to respond like that. So mm-hmm. to me, they're telling on themselves when they're trying to suppress your feeling.
Yeah.
You can tell they're in denial themselves.
Yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So because what you're saying is evocative and they feel compelled to quash you because they need to reinforce their own denial mm-hmm. for themselves of their mother or mm-hmm. their father, right?
Yes.
Okay. So I would say to this person, let's say hypothetically, I said, yeah, you know what? I'm kind of glad my mom's dead. Okay. So let's say I said that and someone said, oh, you can't say that. It's your mother. This is what I would say. Mm-hmm. It seems like you are having a strong reaction to what I just said.
Yeah.
Dear person. And, you know, if my honest reflection makes you uncomfortable, I would encourage you to seek some therapy about why you're so uncomfortable yeah. with my honest reflection and what's underneath your reaction right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
So that's what I wanted to communicate on all of that. Any all
right.
thoughts or reflections, Katie?
Oh, you've just got me thinking now oh, okay. about OCD and mm-hmm. other manifestations of it, like, mm-hmm. you know, cleanliness mm-hmm. rituals, yeah. those kinds of things. And do you think the root of those things are... Yes. Are the same?
Yes, because cleanliness is usually about germs. Uh-huh. It's always about sickness or death or harming someone. So
okay.
That's the common denominator.
And so it still usually has to do with the relationship with the parent.
Yeah. And okay. in fact, yeah, I'm glad you asked this because I would put hypochondria in the same book
yeah.
as OCD.
Okay.
I have clients who show a lot of hypochondria symptoms.
Yeah.
They'll show it with themselves and with their loved ones.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's the exact same root where they have this underlying root of feelings of hatred or like a passive death wish on their parent their whole life. And it shows up in their own fear of sickness and death for themselves and others.
Mm.
Yes. But that's the common denominator is it's harm or sickness.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. All right. Lots to think about.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, thanks for thinking through it with me. And listeners, I just want to encourage you again, please subscribe to this podcast if it has been helpful for you. Please give me that 5-star review to help others see that this is good enough to listen to. And please share it with a friend if it's helped you at all. That would be amazing. And thanks for listening today. Bye-bye.